Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. I'm your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett. We want to welcome to the show today Chris Shelton, and Chris is a former Scientologist and Sea Org member and is now a writer, consultant podcaster, YouTuber, and an advocate for critical thinking. Chris's website is mncriticalthinking.com, and welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Before we get started, I have to know, what does the M and N stand for on your website name?
Well, I originally started when I lived in Minnesota, and my original positioning was the Minnesota critical thinker. And then I moved because Minnesota is sort of an ungodly place to live when you're born and raised in California. And so I came to Denver, which is radically different from Minnesota. Most people don't know that, but it is. And I thought, well, now what am I going to do? Because I can't be the Minnesota critical thinker anymore. And that was where I became the branding change to critical thinker at large, because I was just everywhere. But I had to keep the website because it was the domain name. So there you go.
Okay.
So were the people of Minnesota just making poor choices? Is that why you did the website?
Yeah, it was all about critical thinking, because I didn't want to put myself out there as the ex-Scientologist at large. I didn't think that that was something I wanted to be identified as, you know, that's all I'm known for, you know what I mean? I didn't want that.
Right.
Critical thinking is so much more important and pervasive in our lives that I thought I want to promote and be an advocate for that rather than just being known as somebody who's against something, you know?
Right. So, of course, we want to hear your story about leaving Scientology, but you really have used that experience as a jumping board to help people think through their way through a lot of different scenarios. And looking at your site, I notice you talk about Donald Trump, depression, terrorism, narcissism, and I think there's a theme there. So, you know, we're in this climate where there's a lot of reactionary emotions, and it must feel for you like you're digging your way out of an avalanche with a hand shovel. Let's kind of start from the beginning. Talk about your childhood. Talk about you were raised in Scientology. Explain what that was like as a kid, and we'll kind of work up to how you got to where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. The story is a very simple one. I'm a second gen Scientologist, or was. So I was raised with it. My parents got involved when I was about 4 years old. And, you know, I never had any reason to question or doubt what they were teaching me. And they were teaching me Scientology the same way any Christian household would teach their kids the Bible. So, you know, when you grow up in an environment like that, you simply accept that this is reality. This is how things are. There's a spiritual existence. Spirits are called thetans, not ghosts or spirits. We live, you know, we've lived before, we will live again. The body is just something you have, kind of like a, you know, set of clothes or something. And in other words, it's transient, it's not permanent. You are permanent, but the body is not. And there is a part of your mind that is sort of a subconscious, but always alert, always on, always functioning part of your mind that's responsible for the bad things that you do, your violent tantrums or anger or upset or depression. This all stems from this part of the mind called the reactive mind. All of these were things, these were principles I just grew up thinking this was just how the world is. And I learned in my social interactions, especially once I hit high school, oh no, people think other things, you know, there's other ideas out there. Oh, this reactive mind, nobody else really knows too much about this. And that's when I started finding out that L. Ron Hubbard's ideas were just his ideas. They weren't necessarily like these universal concepts. So I kind of was around it, knew about it, but I wouldn't have called myself a Scientologist, except maybe by default. It wasn't like I was really dogmatic or really passionate about any of this either. It was just kind of how I thought things were. So when I was 15 years old, I was in high school, my dad just kind of said one day, hey, why don't you go down to the local church, which was at that time in Santa Barbara, California, and why don't you find out for yourself what it's all about? And I thought, well, this is going to be boring, but okay. And I went down there and they did what they do with most people. They had me do a personality test and get this, you know, fairly nice looking woman to sit me down and go over it with me. And, you know, I'm a 15-year-old high school student, so I'm pretty much an open book. Everybody kind of knows what 15-year-old boys are going through, but being 15 years old, being rather naive, bookish, kind of nerdy, I thought I was the only one experiencing all of these horrible things that we all go through, you know? They can't talk to girls, they can't get a date, the sudden, all these hormones flying through your system, you know? And I was like, ah. And she says, well, your personality test here shows that you're shy and introverted and I bet you have a hard time getting a date with girls. And I'm like, how did you know? You know, so because so, you know, you think you're, you know, you're keeping all this under wraps, you know. So I was like, you know, just shut up and take my money. I, you know, what am I going to do that's going to handle this? And she said they have this communications class I could take, and it would resolve all of my problems, and I'd get lots of dates. And I thought, well, okay, here we go. And that's how I kind of started with it. And I fell pretty hard pretty fast because I had a whole lifetime of indoctrination in it. And so 2 years later, I finished high school and they recruited me to start working for the organization in Santa Barbara. And I did that for 8 years and came to the conclusion that Scientology was the shit. You know, it was the cat's meow. This stuff was amazing, but nobody really cared about it. Nobody really wanted to do it. We couldn't get people in. It was difficult. And this was in the late 80s and 90s. So I figured about 1995 or so, I was like, well, this isn't really working. I've been working my guts out here as a volunteer, not getting paid anything really, you know, slaving away, working a full-time job in addition to working at the church. So I was pretty dedicated. I was pretty hardcore. And it wasn't taking off. It wasn't doing the things that L. Ron Hubbard, our fearless leader, said it was supposed to be doing in all of his policies and all these issues and hundreds of pages of this stuff that he wrote about how to run Scientology organizations. He said, if it's not taking off and not really succeeding and people aren't, you know, pounding down the door because we've got the world's better, you know, mousetrap, then it's because we're not doing the job right. We're screwing up. It's not Scientology. It's not L. Ron Hubbard. It's us. So I figured, well, I better double down and do more for the cause, take more responsibility. And so I joined what's called the C organization. And that is a paramilitary, you know, ranks and ratings and yes, sir, no, sir, how high should I jump, sir, sort of operation that Hubbard started back in 1967, and he started it with real boats out on the real ocean. So it was called the Sea Organization, as in ocean. And he had people, you know, learning how to drive boats around and learning how to do all kinds of stuff. And he formed up this group as sort of the inner core, most dedicated kind of, you know, in terms of dedication, the Sea Org is on par with, say, a monastery or a nunnery or something, like people who've really dedicated their entire life to the cause. That's what the Sea Org is. You don't have friends or contacts outside of the Sea Org once you join the Sea Org. It's sort of like if you were to live on a military base, it would be difficult to maintain familial connections or friendships outside of that group. Your in-group is, you know, the people around you that you work with. Those tend to be your friends and the people you're hanging out with. And you're not allowed to marry outside the Sea Org when you're in it. So it's, you know, it's just such a dedicated 24/7 sort of thing that it just rules your life.
Do they allow dating within the Sea Org?
Yes, because you can't have sex in the Sea Org until you get married. So there's a whole lot of incentive to date and get married right away. So I was married within 3 months. It was fast. It was real fast. And I worked my ass off for Scientology for 17 more years. I worked really hard. I went through a lot of stuff. And in the end of 2012, I pretty much had I'd come to the place where I had sort of had enough of the lifestyle and the dishonesty and the pressure and the demands and the quotas and the especially the pressure of to make money. It was all about making money. And that was not why I really signed on in the first place, because I certainly wasn't making any money. They were paying us $50 a week. You know, it was not something you don't join the C organization to get rich. So the only guy who's really getting enriched by any of it is the one guy at the very, very top who used to be L. Ron Hubbard. And once he died, a guy named David Miscavige took over.
Yeah.
So after I'd had enough of that, I left the C org at the end of 2012. I still believed in the dogma and practice of Scientology. I just was pretty disaffected with the organization. And I you can separate those two in the same way you could be disaffected with the Pope or the local archbishop or something, I suppose, in a Catholic sense, but you still believe in God and Jesus and you still believe in the rites and rituals. So that was kind of where I was at. But after I got out, I had a lot freer access to things that I did not have access to when I was in. I did not, for example, in the Sea Org, you don't have unrestricted internet access. In fact, hardly anybody has internet access in the Sea Org because there's a lot of anti-Scientology material on the internet and they don't really like their membership looking at any of that stuff. It's verboten. There's a lot of information control. That's one part of why we describe Scientology as a destructive cult, because it engages in what there's a model Steve Hassan put together. He's a cult recovery expert and therapist, and his model is called the BITE model. It's not the only model. There are other ones. In fact, there's even better ones, but this is an easy way to describe it, where you have behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control, and that's called the BITE model, B-I-T-E. So information control in Scientology is quite efficient, and they've got their members in a frame of mind that they dare not look at anything critical of Scientology.
So were you kicked out, or did you leave on your own accord?
No, I left on my own accord, but I left the Sea Org. I didn't leave Scientology, right? It's a big difference there. So they were going to make me jump through a whole bunch of hoops in order to get back into being in fully good standing with the church. And that involves a number of things, including paying for, services that I had received as a Scientologist, that, as a staff member, the only real concession they give you is they give you free Scientology services. So as a staff member, I had gotten up to, I'd received a bunch of Scientology auditing, or what's referred to as auditing. It's kind of like counseling. So as a staff member, I was supposed to, as a former staff member, I was now saddled with a debt that I was supposed to pay that back, and before I could do any more Scientology. So I was sort of kicking my heels, and I moved to Minnesota, and I kind of was like, well, I got some work to do to get back into good graces and get on with Scientology in my life. And so I started seeing things. I had seen some things when I was in, despite having the internet filter and despite, my thought policing, I still had some things break through the armor enough to see that organizationally there were problems. And it got me curious what else was out there. So now that I had unrestricted access and I'm a bit of a voracious reader, I got curious and I started looking.
Which is always dangerous.
Yes. Well, when you're a cult member, it sure is. So I did not know I was a cult member. I mean, I never, ever, I'd heard the word. I laughed it off. I used to joke about it. I used to say, oh, yeah, sure, we're all a cult. Scientology is a cult. Of course it is. And so is the Catholic Church, if you look up the definition of the word. So what's the big deal, right? I would just slough it off with that kind of. That was about as deep as my thinking would go. So once I had unrestricted access, I started plunging down the rabbit hole. And man, it goes down quite a ways. And that was, 3 months of just solid, just sleepless nights up, just reading, watching South Park, watching Tom Cruise make a fool out of himself, watching all this information, reading tons of stuff that I had not been exposed to in Scientology, or worse, had actually been lied to when I was in Scientology. There are a lot of lies about L. Ron Hubbard and his life. I came to learn there's this term called hagiography, which is the biography of a religious leader according to the religion he was a leader of. And hagiographies are always, you know, works of fiction. And L. Ron Hubbard's hagiography in Scientology is a complete fiction, but we all thought it was totally true. In fact, this is probably the biggest one of all, is that he served in World War II, and he was an officer, and he had command of a ship for a while. He claimed that he saw action in Australia. He claimed that he bombed a submarine, shelled a submarine off the coast of Oregon, and that he had all these other adventures in the Navy. Well, we come to find out he never saw a single day of combat.
Wow.
And he said that at the end of the war, he suffered war wounds that blinded him and left him lame and hospitalized, and his family gave up on him. And it was only because he took a year at the Oak Knoll Medical Naval Hospital, and he studied up on the endocrine system and hormones and the body and how the body is put together and the nervous system. And by combining that information with his studies of Freud and psychoanalysis and other things he had picked up over the years through the application of all this stuff that he learned, he claimed that he healed himself. And that he used those principles to develop what became Dianetics, and that he used them on other people at the Oak Knoll Hospital after he had cured himself, and he cured them too. Mm-hmm. And this was supposed to be the basis of Dianetics, the modern science of mental health, which was published in May 1950. And that was the basis of what became Scientology a couple years later. It's a very interesting story, and there's a lot to it, but this is the point being that we were told all of this, and then I find out afterwards that his actual naval records show no combat, no war wounds, no year-long stay at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital. He was flitting around instead down in Southern California practicing the occult with Jack Parsons in Pasadena, California. Funny enough, about 5 minutes away from where I grew up. Finding out lies of that magnitude clearly shook everything I thought I knew since I was a little kid. I mean, I was raised with this. So I had lots of emotional and, you know, mental investment in Scientology being true. You know, I'd spent a good chunk of my life peddling this stuff and believing it, totally believing it. And yeah, no, I'd actually believed in a whole bunch of lies, and I had been taken advantage of, and I had been used basically like a pawn on a chessboard. That had been my position in my home for most of my life, and I had been entirely clueless about it. And to this day, I still don't have the words to describe what it felt like to learn all that, but it was not a pleasant experience.
Tim and I came out of fundamentalism. Different branches of fundamentalism. He was Pentecostal and I was Southern Baptist. So we understand living so many years, and then we both went through conversion therapy. So we understand this whole concept of being told certain things and being required to believe and act in a certain way. And then all of a sudden, through a series of just little lights, being able to break in, then realizing, wow, it's not true. And I understand the feeling of emptiness and kind of vacuum of, well, what now?
Very much so. Very much so.
My first encounter with Hubbard, I read his science fiction books when I was in high school. There was a group of about five or six of us who were very into science fiction, Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury. And I read Hubbard. I didn't know who Hubbard was. He just was a science fiction writer. Mm. But I remember being at the mall one day, and there was a display there of Dianetics, all these books. And it's very vivid in my head, and I don't mean to be dismissive, but when I saw Dianetics, I thought, it's a diet program.
Yeah, right. Dianetics
sounded like, oh, good, another weight loss program, because I'm always looking for a new weight loss program. And I stood and talked to it was an older guy, just, you know, very personable, very nice. And we talked for a long time because I had read the science fiction book. So I look back on it and think, you know, wonder how close I was to being sucked into all of it.
Pretty close. And in fact, the science fiction route is one road into Scientology. There's a whole branch of what is ultimately the organizations of Scientology, but it is a separate for-profit group called Author Services, and they are responsible for Hubbard's fiction works, and they publish those. They're sort of a like an agent, like the author's agent.
Yes.
And that's what that organization does. And it's staffed by Sea Org members. So, you know, that kind of tells you, what are they up to? Well, they're publishing all of Hubbard's fiction works with the idea of promoting and popularizing L. Ron Hubbard's name so that that exact reaction you just had will happen, where somebody will see Dianetics and go, oh, L. Ron Hubbard, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and ask questions and get sucked in. So
I have to ask, Chris, did the people at the top know that this was a lie? Does Tom Cruise know that this is a lie? I mean, what do they actually know? And the reason I ask this is because we often get this from, as conversion therapy survivors, and Bill and I were actually both leaders in that movement for a while. And there's an automatic assumption that you're lying, that you know exactly what you're doing, that you're deceiving these people when you're just as sucked into it as everybody else is. So I'm just curious of how much they know or how much they lead on. Or I mean, what's going on up there?
No, they don't know. David Miscavige has to know. There's no way he couldn't know. But everybody else are true believers. It's kind of like that. Tom Cruise is... I mean, I can't say for sure. I've never met Tom Cruise. I've never spoken with him, but
I have. I actually met him several. It wasn't in a Scientology thing, but a friend of mine, Tom was doing a movie here in Dallas years ago, born on the 4th of July. And a friend of mine was an extra. And I went to pick up this friend of mine to go to dinner. And he and I were standing there talking. And he said something about going to dinner, and then somebody behind me says, "Where are you guys going?" I turn around and there's Tom Cruise.
Wow.
So it was like, and he introduced himself and we shook hands, and he knew the friend of mine who was the extra and chatted briefly, and that was it. He didn't go to dinner with us though.
Oh, bummer. Well, that was a time period where he actually was not involved in Scientology also, by
yes.
the way.
Right. Speaking of Cruise, let me ask that question, because most people, when they talk about Scientology or hear Scientology, they think about the very famous people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta, who are active, and then those who have left, you know, like Leah Remini and Katie Holmes. But what is it about Scientology that attracts powerful people?
Well, it promises to give you power. It promises to give you total spiritual freedom and personal immortality and full awareness of those things, and gets you to a place where spiritually you are at peace. You are at cause over life. That's the expression that's used in Scientology, is being cause over life.
Cause over life.
And
okay.
The concepts of cause and effect are very important in Scientology. Hubbard did not like not being in control of things. So being at cause means you're the one who's emanating or originating the factors of your life. You're the one who's in charge of your life. You're the one who's in charge of what goes on around you. Being at the effect, there's cause and effect, right? So being at effect in Scientology is not a good thing. You don't want to be at effect. That means you're being victimized. You're being, you know, you're not the one who has a say in what's happening to you. So Scientology's whole thing is putting you at cause. And who doesn't want to be in the driver's seat, right? Especially somebody like Tom Cruise, for example. I mean, he's practically manic on the subject. So that's what Scientology promises to give to people. And it doesn't start all that on day one. It, you know, you don't walk in and go, hey, what's this all about? And they go, it's about being a, you know, a cause over your entire life. I mean, they, you know, nobody says that. They go, well, what are the problems of your life? What kind of things are you running into? You don't know what to do anything about. And for Tom Cruise, that was the dyslexia. He had dyslexia.
Yes.
And Scientology has a methodology of how to study. And one of the factors of that, one of the most important one, is that when you're studying stuff, have a dictionary. Look up the words you don't understand. Clear them up. Make sure you understand what you're reading. There's nothing particularly wrong with that as a principle, but like all things in Scientology, or really any destructive cult, you take something good or you take something useful or beneficial or basically helpful, and you amp it up to 11. You know, you make it so that it's not just looking up words in a dictionary as helpful to your study. It becomes, it's the only thing that you need to do, right? And anybody who has any problem with study, well, it's only because they have not cleared up their words. And you ignore every other facet of problems with education. And you say, this is the only thing that matters, right? So yes, that's where it goes off the rails. So Tom Cruise was helped. He was legitimately helped in his studies and his difficulties with reading by this principle. And he went, you know, this stuff works. And he made the classic mistake that every single person who falls for these destructive cults makes. Well, if that's true, it must all be true.
Right.
And that is a huge, huge failure in critical thinking.
That gives me I got a bunch of questions all of a sudden going on in my head.
Yeah, I bet.
But yeah, we're going to stop for just about 30 seconds and talk about the organization, not C organization, our organization, Recovering from Religion. We'll be right back.
Recovering from Religion is funded by those who believe in what we do. We invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. Go to our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and click on the donate button for instructions. On the website, you'll also find an extensive database of resources, including links, articles, and videos. We offer 24-hour phone and chat line support, along with the links to meetup groups in 20 communities around the U.S. With our secular therapy project, we can connect you with a professional who offers evidence-based, non-religious treatment. Our partner therapists understand the complexities of rethinking or leaving your faith. Finally, Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer with us, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the volunteer tab.
As you were talking about, as you come in, you buy into one aspect to solve a problem, and then you end up kind of buying the whole everything.
Yes.
And again, I hate to keep bringing it back because it, you know, in most of my life, it is all about me, but it's not. I just,
no,
I can relate to what you're saying.
Of course.
Because some of the same things in conversion therapy, we find people who have one area, one problem area, and, you know, we're there, we help them. And then, but I wanted to use that because I have a question that maybe you can answer, because there are a lot of mixed messages that come out of Scientology in relation to conversion therapy and, being gay. is this something you're willing to talk about?
Because they
send a lot of mixed messages. I mean, you know, I read stories of that they have conversion therapy programs, but then there's other, some of the celebrities talk about, no, we're very supportive of LGBTQ people. Tell me your perspective on this.
All right. So basically, you have more lies being told there. Okay.
You can't see me. There's a shocked look on my face.
Yeah, exactly. Right. What? You're kidding. No, it's true. I can't say for sure that Laura Prepon or, you know, any other Scientology celebrity who gets asked about this, I can't say for sure that they know they're lying, but it's about 99% sure that they are. I mean, I'll put it there, right? Because I know that they have read the materials that L. Ron Hubbard wrote about the subject of homosexuality and sexual perversion. And those materials are from Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, which he wrote back in 1950 with a 1950s Midwest morality. And a year later, he wrote another book called Science of Survival. And that has even more about this. And basically, the premise in regards to sexual perversions, as he called it, is, you know, sadism, masochism, anything having to do with kids, of course, and homosexuality. These are all classified under this umbrella of sexual perversion. And it's not, Hubbard makes it clear that it's not necessarily a point of morality. It's a point of insanity. He calls it a mental aberration and a kind of, I don't think he uses the word psychosis, but a kind of, but analogous to that. And it causes, you know, a person who has tendencies like that will have all kinds of other tendencies like lying, stealing, dishonesty, stabbing you in the back. He calls it a covert hostility. And he pegs it on an emotional tone scale that he created, a scale of emotions. With this second book, Science of Survival, he put up this chart. It's called the Chart of Human Evaluation. And on that chart, he has a lot of boxes that lay out against a scale of numbers various ways that people act. For example, their honesty level or how they feel about children is one column. How they handle truth is another column on this chart. And the lower you go on the chart, the worse off you are, down all the way to zero, which is dying, it's death. So at the bottom of the scale, you're dead. And at the top of the scale, you're this, you know, wonderful, amazing, moral, honest, you know, gung-ho, energetic person who's just conquering life all around you. And you have all these gradations in between. So at the point of 1.1 on this scale, which is pretty low, because the scale goes up to like 40 and beyond, Hubbard pegs all homosexuality, the entirety of anything having to do with the LGBTQ community, would fall at 1.1 on the scale. And if you run your eyes across that chart, you see that this is a level of dishonesty, of sneakiness, of, again, stabbing you in the back, of treating children badly, and of homosexuality. Now, this is not to say that everybody at the point of 1.1 is a homosexual. It's to say that on the Venn diagram, all homosexuals are 1-1. That is Scientology dogma. That's not an optional thing. That's not something you get to go, oh, well, I don't really, you know, Hubbard gets a lot of things right, but this whole thing about the gays, that's just crazy talk. No one in Scientology gets to say stuff like that. So, because it's a destructive cult. It's, you know, it's Hubbard's way or the highway. If you don't like it, there's the door, you know? So, so all Scientologists buy into this, and there's pages and pages of Hubbard expounding on this in these books. So he considered homosexuality or anything like it to be a mental aberration. And therefore in Scientology, you do have conversion therapy, and it's, you know, it's auditing the gay away. You don't pray it away, you audit it away, and you use Scientology counseling procedures or auditing to address it. And I watched that happen a couple times when I was in Scientology. And I'm sorry to say that I was a true believer. I really bought into what Hubbard said about that. And it took a conscientious effort on my part. That year I got out in 2013, I actually tackled that belief head on because I wanted to know for myself after I realized how bad Scientology actually was and all the lies connected with it. I still had this homophobia. And I thought to myself, well, do I have this because L. Ron Hubbard said it or because I really think this and this is really how things are? So I started doing a lot of research and I got a lot of questions answered and I talked to a lot of people and I am now very, very much an ally and I am very much not homophobic anymore. I made a very conscientious effort to overcome all that nonsense from Scientology and I now, you know, I'm very, very vocally active for the LGBTQ community. So you can change, you know, it's not like you're stuck in that position, but it takes some critical thinking to overcome it. So
it's just really interesting to me that, you know, your statement about because you wrote it back in the 1950s, which is pretty typical of what it was in the 1950s. And people are relying on what L. Ron Hubbard said back then, just like people are relying on what was written in the Bible 2,000 or 3,000 years ago.
Right.
It's in stone. They said it. Therefore, it must be true. We can't look at science. We can't look at anything outside of what these beliefs are.
Correct.
So let's kind of go the next step. So how did you then, you left Scientology and you got into critical thinking. And I like how you've taken that in other directions. You don't just talk about Scientology, but you talk about a lot of other things.
Yes, very much so. I'm big on talking, obviously. I don't mind talking. And it all came from asking myself one very, very important question. And I kind of, you know, pat myself on the back on this one, because it's not something that all people who come out of destructive cults do. And I, through luck or happenstance or smart or whatever, I don't really care. I found about critical thinking because I asked myself, how do I make sure that I don't go from one cult to another? What do I need to do to make sure this never, ever happens to me again? Because, you know, when you get sucked into something like that and it consumes literally half of your lifetime, you don't want to waste the other half. You know, you go suddenly, you're like, whoa, I can't get any of those years back. My childhood's gone. My younger, you know, wild years were, I was sowing the oats of Scientology, not mine, you know, like this was not, I did not have a, you know, a normal experience that other people have. So I wanted to get normal real fast. And I wanted to find out what that was all about. And I wanted to live a life that actually mattered and on my own terms, not somebody else's terms. And I didn't want to ever be fooled like that again. So I started Googling, how do you detect bullshit? You know, how do you know when somebody's feeding you a bunch of crap? Because it's not obvious. It's not apparent. It's not always because they're telling you blatant lies that anybody should be able to see through. It doesn't work that way. If it was that easy, there wouldn't be any destructive cults. These people are really good at what they do. So how do you avoid that? And I started Googling, and lo and behold, what comes up right away? I just lucked into it. The Baloney Detection Kit, a chapter of the book written by Carl Sagan called A Demon Haunted World, or The Demon Haunted World. Right? Science is a candle in the darkness of ignorance. That book changed everything for me. It was first the chapter alone, because I read it on the internet and I was like, wow, here's somebody that I actually know of, Carl Sagan. I'd only known about him briefly as a child through Cosmos, you know, and billions and billions of stars.
Billions.
You know? And I thought he was kind of a funny guy. I didn't know that much about him. And I started reading this chapter, and I was suddenly, my respect for him just shot out the roof, because this was a smart, able communicator who was talking about how to not get fooled by things. And he wasn't offering an alternative belief system. He was saying, use this to evaluate any information that comes your way and make up your own mind about it. I'm not going to tell you what to think. You figure out what to think. But here's some tools to help you out. And I just went, wow, this is just about the most perfect thing I could have possibly stumbled across. So I then got the book and I read the whole thing. And it was a revelation for me. And I know that's a religious term, but it was almost a religious experience in that it was very life-altering for me. And I found Skeptic.com, James Randi Foundation, Michael Shermer, Penn and Teller, this whole world that I didn't know existed of people who question things and debunk claims. And they were debunking claims I didn't even know I needed debunked. ESP, you know, what's his name? Ingo Swan, you know, remote viewing, like all this stuff that I had bought into in Scientology, because they believe in all that stuff.
So let me ask you this about when we came out of Christianity. Of course, there's so much emotion involved with that. And of course, speaking for myself, coming out of Pentecostal Christianity, my emotions were completely enveloped in what I believed. Was that the same for you? Did you feel like there was an emotional component, or do you feel like you kind of cut the emotional component out and it was just all intellect?
That's a good question and a little bit of a complicated answer because of the nature of Scientology. When I was a Scientologist, and especially when I was a Sea Org member, Hubbard has a policy for his staff members that filters down to the public Scientologist, but really is only rigorously applied when you're a staff member or a Sea Org member. And the policy is called no case on post. And that's a rather vague term. So what I mean by that is, in Scientology, the collective, you know, mass of nonsense that you've been carrying around with you for billions of years, because remember, in Scientology, you've lived before. All the trauma, all the stress, all the bad experiences, every crappy thing that's ever happened to you that is causing you to be stuck in this body and this material universe on this prison planet called Earth that we can't get out of. We can't break out of the cycle of birth and death and birth and death. We're caught up in this endless repetition that we've been doing for billions of years. And all the accumulated stress and trauma and all of that is called your case. That's the word for it in Scientology. It's your case. So when you go into auditing, you open up your case. You address your case. You start dealing with your case. Outside of auditing, you don't touch it. You don't mess with it. You don't have it. You act as though it doesn't exist. The problem, of course, is it does exist. You do have trauma. You do have stress. You do have painful things that have happened to you. Maybe child abuse, maybe, you know, bullying, maybe any number of things that happen to people. And it's not so easy to just sweep that under the rug. That has an effect on people, and it has sometimes has long-term effects. That would all be called your case. And when you're on your job or your post, because again, they're using military terms because it's a whole, you know, semi-paramilitary outfit, the Sea Org. When you're on your post, there's no case. You know, no upset, no dramatizing, no showing emotion like that, no being angry or getting all griefy or upset or sad or apathetic. None of that. Can't be any of that. You got to smile, you got to put a good face on it, and you got to just do your work and have a high morale. And Hubbard even wrote a little poem to help Scientologists out with this called The Spirit of Play. And I don't know that I recall the whole thing, but it basically goes something along the lines of, force yourself to smile and you'll soon stop frowning. Force yourself to laugh and you'll soon find something to laugh about. A being causes his own emotions. The greatest joy there is in life is creating. Splurge on it. So that, I think that's the whole poem. So that is the attitude that Scientologists and Sea Org members are supposed to have about their emotional state of being. And I was in the Sea Org for 17 years, and I did not get any auditing, hardly any. So there wasn't really any time for me to go unpack and decompress and bare my soul and lay it all out and, you know, talk about that case. I had to suppress it all. And it becomes a psychologically damaging habit where you're constantly suppressing your emotions. And I'm sorry for the long backstory on having to explain all of that, but I have to in order to get across the fact that just because I got out of Scientology doesn't mean that all went away. That habit was very, very inculcated in me. So when I got out, I had this emotional devastation of realizing that my life had been, you know, a con for most of my life. And yet I had this really bad habit of not being able to express my emotions because I had suppressed them for so long that they became difficult to express. It took me months. Actually, if I'm really going to be honest, it took a couple years before it started dawning on me that I really had a hard time expressing my emotions like everybody else does. And so that was a whole nother level of complete horseshit that Scientology had sort of put on me that I had to break free of. But first I had to realize there was even a problem. Then I had to figure out, how do I address this problem and how do I actually process grief? How do I process, you know, loss? How do I deal with anger in a constructive way, not a destructive way? Because when you suppress emotions like that, when they come out, it's monstrous. You know, kind of thing. Because you're not controlling it well because it's been bottled up for so long. It just comes out like a demon, right? And that wasn't so good. So I kind of had some like, oh, maybe there's some anger management and how do I process this grief of having lost all these friends and family and stuff? And that took a long time to process.
Did you use therapy or was it?
No, it was pretty much me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, no, it was pretty much me.
That's healthy.
For me, coming out of the Pentecostal movement, I did not trust my feelings. I thought my feelings had lied to me. It led me down this path. And like you, our stories are pretty similar here, right? So I went to graduate school and I studied cognition and I got my education degree, but I read Shermer. I read all these psychologists. I read Jonathan Haidt. It was just trying to wrap my brain around what the hell happened and how do I make sure this doesn't happen again? I think with a lot of people coming out of that kind of religious experience, though, I do think that it's very difficult to try to get our emotions and our intellect together. Is that we learn to separate those. Like you were saying, we learn to push this down and not have to deal with that. And so we become very intellectual. But then there's this dualism that's going on that's unhealthy, and we just can't seem to bring those two things together. So my question to you is, when you are dealing with something so traumatic, and it was traumatic, how do you take those emotions and work that into getting to a place where there is critical thinking? And again, because, you know, for me, I deal with depression. So you feel like you're kind of moving up the ladder, depression hits and you fall all the way back down to the bottom. And a lot of that really has to do with those experiences that have taught you and told you that you're not good enough. It's going to keep you down. You're not going to really know the truth. You really can't get to this place anymore. And so it's this cycle that we get in. And we're just trying to figure out what is true. So just those building blocks of establishing critical thinking in our lives, how do we make that happen?
Well, first is learning about it. And that is crucial. People skip the education step way too much and then they expect miracles. You have to do the study. You got to take the time. You got to research this stuff. And by research, I mean learn. You know, right now I'm actually doing research on emotions. I'm doing a video on this whole Hubbard's emotional, that chart I was telling you about in that tone scale. And I'm diving deep on this stuff. And it's absolutely fascinating because, you know, emotions are a very not well understood thing. You know, there's a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of study on it. And I had no clue, you know, when I was in Scientology, how complex it can be. Same with our thinking processes. You know, you don't have to go become a neurologist. I'm not suggesting anything like that. You don't have to go to grad school, but it is a worthwhile activity to read up on psychology and sociology and neurology and see what are these cognitive mechanisms? How does this stuff work? What are emotions? How does that play into it? And, you know, realizing as a critical thinker that, you know, there's no escaping emotions. It's not like we have two halves of our brain and if we separate them, we'll be better off or something. It turns out, for example, that when people have brain damage that impairs their ability to emote, they suddenly can't make any decisions. You know, their decision-making process totally sucks. What's that about? Because you'd think if you turn the emotions off, you'll be like Mr. Spock. But no, it doesn't actually work that way. And we're just barely getting to understand how we think, you know? And learning about this stuff really is therapeutic. It's very, very cathartic because I apply this to myself and my own thought processes and those of others. And I find that it helps me overcome all the false information that was kind of shoved down my throat. But it also makes me come to a place where I've sort of realized that we're still figuring all this stuff out. And it's a little frustrating at times to not be able to just open a book and get a nice, clean, solid, concise answer to something. I mean, Hubbard offers tons of those, as do all other cult leaders. You know,
yes, they do.
But those answers are fake answers. It's fake news, you know, because the truth is that the world is a very, very complicated place. And we are very, very complicated creatures. We got a lot going on in our heads. No one understands consciousness. No one. I mean, they, you know, anybody who says they do, they either don't know what they're talking about or they're selling something, you know? So learning about this kind of is difficult because you learn how little we know about some things, but you also learn a lot about how people are trying to figure this stuff out. and the different ways that they're trying to figure it out. You know, you approach emotion, for example, from the viewpoint of a psychologist, you're going to have a whole different conversation than the conversation you're going to have with a sociologist or a neurologist or an ethnologist.
Or a theologian.
That's right. You know, you're going to have wildly different conversations about the exact same thing.
But I think people like the. As I've listened to you talk about Scientology, and I relate back to my fundamentalism background, and the people that I still deal with, because for 30 years I've dealt with people who were in conversion therapy or who had been harmed by that. I find the consistency is we like these simple answers. Give me seven steps to overcome this. Give me five ways to stop doing this.
Exactly.
We like black and white.
That's right.
And critical thinking is then a tool. And I mean, Tim, you and Tim are the expert. I'm the good listener. But I think that we like those things. But critical thinking allows us to see the people who say that and go, they don't have it figured out either.
Well, that's exactly right. And when you learn about the fact that we accept facts based on how we feel about them, rather than whether they're objectively true or not, for example, that's the preferred method of intaking information for human beings. It's very eye-opening because it explains a lot of behavior out there. It explains a lot of the mistakes we make in our own lives. For me personally, I'm not only fascinated by the process of it, but I try to use it in my life, and I make little videos, talking about this stuff to people on my channel because I want them to learn from what I'm learning about too. But I find myself able to be more rational or be more objective about all sides of political questions, religious questions, religious thinking, because I understand how people intake information, or at least I understand it better than I used to. So I think it gives you a leg up. If you conscientiously use this information, it gives you the ability to judge things and not be, and exactly the goal I was trying to achieve, which is how do I avoid going from one cult to another? Well, I now know how to do that. But it's taken years of being very open-minded, receiving, looking into a lot of different stuff and making sure that when I start sensing dogmatism in my mind, I know what that feels like. And you start going, oh boy, okay, hold on, boy, pull back the reins, And I'm finding that there is no such thing as healthy dogmatism, no matter what you're pushing, even science,
Oh, yes.
You can get dogmatic about that. You can get dogmatic about atheism just as much as you can get dogmatic about belief,
Yes.
And that's where we always fall down. And I think that the root of that falling down is a lack of understanding of what's going on in our heads and the dangerous, the fact that we're not cautious enough about how we think. And how we process information and what we choose to do with it, that's where I think critical thinking education really needs to happen. It's not about learning facts; it's about learning how to think.
And there's some interesting research on the differences between conservatives and liberals, where our personalities are set. Where for those of us that grew up in a conservative environment, we are very black and white. And I deal with this with a lot of people who are former Christians that came from fundamentalism, or people that just are more conservative, where you see they draw these very distinct lines and there isn't a lot of gray. And I know for myself, even though I come from that, even though I've studied cognition, I study how people learn, I try to do the same thing you were talking about, where it's not so much taking sides as it is putting out information that says, let's take a look at this, let's talk about this, let's see what the other side says. And yet, there are times where I get sucked into, I cannot think clearly. I'm so angry, or I feel so much emotion, especially about politics, and especially nowadays, where I can see it. It's all so very clear to me. And part of me wants to easily and simplify this, the different sides is that these people are just idiots.
Yes.
And that's why they can't do that. I know better than that. I know I know how they think. I was a Republican for most of my life, so I understand how they think, how the conservative mm-hmm. mind thinks. But it doesn't help me do any better when there's so much emotion coming up that just kind of takes over my mind, my thinking.
Yes.
So getting through the critical thinking process is difficult, even when you've been doing this
completely.
For a while.
And I have said that many times on my channel, because it does take, you're fighting your brain when you're doing critical thinking. It's not our natural yes. process. I used to think that. I thought, oh, it's a Mr. Spock Bones Star Trek sort of analogy. No, that's actually not right. what it is. It's much worse than that. It's, you know, we're tuned to believe crazy shit. We're tuned to accept things because it yes. feels good. And we're tuned to only accept information that confirms our preconceived ideas. It takes effort. It takes conscientious effort to overcome that. And that is work that unfortunately most people just don't want to do. And it's hard to do. So I understand why they don't want to do it. But you know, the bottom line is, if you want to live a crazy, prejudiced, biased life, well, okay. I mean, you can do that. But, you know, I try to do something better than that. And I'm not trying to put myself on a pedestal. I want everybody else up here too. I'm not like saying I'm like senior to everybody else. I'm very, very much not. I have no laurels to rest on. I was a Scientologist for 27 years, man. You know, I was an idiot. And I always call myself a slow learner, because I usually have to hit my head against the wall about 4 or 5 times before I start going, you know, this is a little uncomfortable. Maybe I should be doing something different here.
I think you called it out, right? So Jonathan Haidt uses the analogy of the elephant and the rider. I'm not sure if you've seen that or familiar with that, where he talks about how the elephant represents our emotions, and that's what we usually react to. So it's our gut reaction. And then the rider represents the much smaller ability
yes,
to think and reason.
I like that. I've not heard that analogy before, but it's perfect. I've got the Righteous Mind on my bookshelf here. I need to, it's on my list to get to.
That's a good book. It's a heavy yes, book. I read that one.
Yeah. So I empathize. You know, it's difficult, and it's also not a popular subject. I mean, who wants to talk about critical thinking? Not too many people.
I still write about faith and religion and that union of religion and politics. So I interact with people a lot on this subject, and they really do want me to take hard and fast stances on things that I used to take hard and fast stances on. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to move them to any place because they're locked in, and I can't, I'm like Tim, I get angry and impatient, but I was there. I was them.
Yes, exactly. And I've been down those roads as well. When I was a Scientologist, I was pretty conservative. After I got out of Scientology, I became very liberal. Now I'm more centrist, because I saw, again, when I was referring to that dogmatism that I was falling into, it politically. And I started seeing the us versus them and the black and white thinking and myself. And I was like, oh boy, something's, you know, because the objective truth is that there is objective truth on both sides or all sides of these spectrums. So you can't just, you know, you could say, well, they're all a bunch of lying scumbags and, you know, a bunch of libtards and eh. Or you could just as easily say, well, you know, those conservatives and those Trumpsters, they just want to kill all of us and destroy America and ruin healthcare, and it's all about the billionaires. And so, I mean, you hear all this crap. The truth is that, you know, no, those black and white generalizations are really never true. You're talking about, you know, a couple experiences that you had. And then you exaggerate them or hype them up or falsely represent them as the entirety of the other side. And that's where we fail. And again, it's natural. It's tribalism. We are built to do that. So you're trying to get people to overcome their most natural instincts to avoid the kind of conflict that occurs because of tribalism. And that's where we're at in the modern world. And we've never, ever been in our history in a place where we are confronting that problem so head on as we are now. But it's a little bit of a race, because we've also got tools and weapons that could wipe us all out. And we've got this climate change thing. I mean, we've got some real problems we've created. And And so I don't know where it's going to go. I'm not Mr. Prediction, but I am concerned, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's why I advocate. If I'm an advocate for anything, it's for counting to 10 and chilling the hell out. And, you know, and like, just, you know, when you do that and you just come back to it the next day, or you give yourself a little bit of a break, you can kind of just, oh, okay, you can kind of regroup and you can kind of get out of the passion and heat of the moment. It's that passion and heat that causes most of the problems that we have.
So, Chris, I want to thank you for your time, but tell the audience where they can find you, what you're doing. Give a little bit of information.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I'm on YouTube under my name, Chris Shelton. I am the Critical Thinker at Large. I have a website, which is mncriticalthinking.com. I've written a book about Scientology, which is a critical analysis of the subject. It's not my memoir. It is a hardcore breakdown of Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard and how they got tax exemption and blackmailed the IRS to get it and all kinds of fun stuff. That's all in a book called Scientology A to Xenu. So you can get that on Amazon. I did an audiobook as well of that. So that's available. And I'm, you know, I think I'm pretty easy to find. If you Google Chris Shelton Scientology, I come right up. If you Google Chris Shelton, you might get the baseball player. Or a few other people. But if you put Scientology after my name, believe me, I come right up. So, and I really advocate for sensible thinking. I don't pretend that I'm always sensible. I'm not trying to be a role model. I'm trying to be an advocate for a better life through better thinking. And I do the best I can with it. I fall down all the time, just like everybody else does, but I pick myself back up. And I think that's really all we can ask of ourselves. And so that's what my channel is all about.
I appreciate that stance. I really do.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Thanks again. And again, I actually went through some of your videos and watched them. It was very intriguing. It kind of pulled me in as I was listening to the things that you were saying. So I highly recommend, if you want to go out there, learn about critical thinking, learn a little bit more about Scientology, check out the website and all the things that Chris has to offer. So Chris, again, thank you so much for joining us. And it has
awesome,
been a
man.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.